Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. ArchiCAD is the official BIM software of the Entree Architect community. ArchiCAD BIM software enables design, collaboration, visualization, and project delivery no matter the project size or complexity. With flexible licensing options and a dedicated support team to guide us along the way, ArchiCAD is an ideal choice for firms and projects of any size. I encourage you to reach out and talk to the folks at Graphisoft by visiting our own dedicated webpage at graphisoft.com/us/EntreeArchitect. There's even an exclusive special offer waiting for our Entree Architect community. Go now to graphisoft.com/us/EntreeArchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioned to help make your architecture firm a success. That's graphisoft.com/us/EntreeArchitect. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Michael Porras, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Mark, it's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here. I'm super interested in this conversation, and the work that you're doing in Detroit and the projects that you're working on. So I'm looking forward to having this conversation. Detroit is one of those cities that I went to visit Detroit as a very young child. Haven't been there since, but I'm fascinated about of how it became where we all sort of have it in our mind where it is today. But now we're coming in the last decade or so. It's being reborn, right, and redeveloped and all kinds of things. And so I'm excited about having this conversation about Detroit. Before we do that, though, I want to learn more about you. Let me introduce you, and then we'll learn more about you and your history. Michael Porras is founding principal of McIntosh Porras Associates, a full-service architecture, interior, and urban design practice in Birmingham, Michigan. Since returning to Detroit in 1995, Michael has been working to implement change in his hometown, preserving many of Detroit's 20th century landmark buildings, historic districts, and iconic neighborhoods. Michael's design leadership has helped transform Detroit with projects such as the Foundation Hotel and the East Riverfront Framework Plan. Michael is currently working on an adaptive reuse of the 600,000 square foot Fisher Body Plant in Detroit, and a 600 prefabricated home community in Colorado. I'm super interested in the Fisher Body Plant because I'm a car guy. I grew up with Chevys and Cadillacs, and I remember the little Fisher Body emblem on the Cadillacs. And so I'm that's sort of a place that's near and dear to my heart. And so I'm interested in that, in where what that is and where it's going. Michael has recently been awarded the AIA Detroit Charles Blessing Award, recognizing an individual who shows leadership in planning and civic issues and exemplifies the vision, commitment, and the accomplishments of Charles A. Blessing. He's the visionary Detroit city planner who committed himself to the pursuit of a higher quality of life for all. So, Michael, that shares a little bit about who you are and the work that you're doing. I'd love to know more about you as an architect. When did you discover your passion for architecture, and maybe who or what inspired you to get started in this profession?
I was pretty young. My mother was an artist, and from my father was a developer. So I kind of got it from both sides. They were both from New York, my mother from Brooklyn, my dad from Manhattan. My mother had attended the Art Students League in NYU and danced with Martha Graham, like back in the 40s.
Yeah.
So she had a pretty serious art background and a studio behind our house that I grew up working in ceramics and sculpture. So I grew up doing art and drawing. And I want to say I was probably like 7 when I said I wanted to be an architect. And of course, kid, you don't really know what that is, but right. I used to like drawing houses, and I was sort of fascinated by it just as a kid. And I grew up in a 1955 mid-century house that was actually a prefabricated house designed by Carl Koch, who's now known as the grandfather of prefab. And so it was a tech built, it was a ranch tech built home, and in a whole neighborhood designed by him here in Farmington Hills, and just now really being rediscovered. But so I grew up in an atmosphere of really great design, and sort of again getting it back and forth. So I think that was a big
You had no choice but to become an architect. It was like this. You had a mother who was an artist and a sculptor, and a father who was a developer, and you lived in an architecturally significant house in an architecturally significant neighborhood. It's like, did you know of any other option?
Right, exactly. And the neighborhood was full of designers. Like great graphic designer across the street from Cranbrook, and car designers. And so, I grew up around this stuff, not really realizing.
Yeah. Do you remember, and it probably was too early to remember, because your story is interesting, because usually architects, when it's early, it's usually about 9 or 10 years old. And it's some event that happened in their life, but you sort of grew up in it. So you were sort of exposed to it your entire life. Do you remember a moment where you realized, oh, this is architecture, and an architect is what I want to be?
I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think I knew, because my dad was in development, I met architects like Yamasaki when I was a kid. And Louis Redstone, who was another one who had worked for Eliel Saarinen and had a practice here in Detroit. And both of whom told me not to do it.
Typical architects.
Exactly. And luckily I didn't listen to them.
Yeah, that's nothing new, people. People, architects have been trying to talk people out of being architects for generations.
Yeah, and so it's, I think it's something to be really conscious of when, and frankly, I've been telling people lately that, the excuse was, oh, it's really hard and you'll never make money. And I think these days, that's not necessarily true.
Agreed.
Principals and firms actually can make quite a bit of money, especially bigger corporate firms. And I don't think that gets said to students that often.
Yeah.
So it's not really the poor man's profession that it used to be. And there's a shortage of architects. So I think it's a disservice to continue that.
Yeah.
That narrative.
So you were exposed early. lived in a home that was architecturally significant. So when you decided you were going to be an architect very, very young. So how did the path to becoming an architect look for you?
So I took drafting classes in high school and, was working in my mother's studio all the time after school. So I grew up around it. All my parents' friends lived in modern homes with, with Eames and Knoll and, all the great furniture. So, when I'd go to other people's houses that were like colonial, I'd be like, I thought there was something wrong with us because it was like different than, other people. Little did I know, I was super lucky to have, an Eames rocking chair from 1953 and a George Nelson dresser in my room, growing.
Wow.
So I had this idea of architecture. So I always thought, well, when I go to college, I'm going to study architecture. Now, and I worked in high school. I worked in a firm that used to do all the retail firm that did all the Kmarts across the country. So I was drafting Kmart parking lot.
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny. So I started early. Then I went, I lived in Israel for a year after high school. And traveled, and that was a great experience. And then came back and started school to be an architect, and was immediately confronted with the prerequisites for bachelor science, the stuff I wasn't crazy about, like chemistry and calculus. And but I got through it. I was at Mentor Michigan undergrad. And then worked during the summers in a firm here that was four partners that came out of Yamasaki's and one from IMPEI. One of them had been the project architect for the World Trade Center. I'd worked on it for like 10 years. And so, the drawings for that were in the print room where I was going through, and then I graduated from Michigan and I went to New Haven, Connecticut and started working for Caesar Pelli and attended Yale part-time, focusing mostly on history, history of art, history of architecture, modern history. Worked at Caesar, started there in 85 when there were 15 to 20 people in the office, just coming out of the early 80s recession, and was there for 2 years. Well, it grew to 75, but great period to be there and, worked on, I don't even know how many projects, but projects all over the place from Carnegie Hall Addition, the Pacific Design Center to, projects and all over. It was a great experience. And then I left there and I went to California to go to SIAR. And so in 87, that was the year Michael Rotondi took over. And so my first semester, I had Tom Main for my studio, which was great. And Wolf Pree had just started teaching there that semester and Todd Williams. And, it was like Neil Denari, like Peter Zumthor was teaching there. It was an amazing.
All the icons, the modern icons of the time.
Except they weren't icons yet.
Right, exactly, before, right.
Yeah, this was 87. So certainly Morphosis was known. Todd Williams was known, but it wasn't. Peter Zumthor was not known at that point. So I had amazing teachers there at SIARC. So I had Tom, I had Wolf Free, I had Robert Mangurian, I had Craig Hodgetts and Bahram Sherdell, and Anthony Bidler and Kurt Forrester, and just like it couldn't have been a better time to be there. And being in LA. My first year, I was working at Frank Gehry's office and Richard Meyer's office, building models and doing stuff. So it was just a great place to be in the mid to late 80s. And then I worked for Tom for Morphosis for 2 years while I was in school and graduated into the recession. So I went to work in Japan for 4 months working on a theme park in Kyushu in the southern island of Japan. That was
how did you end up in Japan? Just chose we have to get out of here. I'm going to Japan.
No, it was through a friend. A friend's boyfriend was the head of design at this Landmark Entertainment, who did a lot of theme parks and Universal Studios and stuff like that. And they were hiring architects to go to Japan. So I sent in my portfolio. I went to interview.
So it was an opportunity.
I didn't even know what the job was. They hired me, paid me double what I'd been making, sent me to Japan. I'm like, great.
How long were you in Japan?
4 months. And it was really beautiful. On the southern island of Japan, Beppu, which is like a vacation city, it's like their Las Vegas, only it's 4,000 onsen, 4,000 hot springs, right on the ocean. It was just great.
Were you there long enough to learn Japanese?
I did have a tutor, and I learned enough to travel around.
Yeah,
spent a month at the end traveling around Japan, and 2 weeks in Kyoto alone, visiting temples and tea houses and gardens, and Ando's work is really what I fell in love with.
Yeah, one of my favorites.
So that was a great, and honestly, it really changed my point of view, because at that point I'd been in school for like 10 years. And next thing I know, I'm in Japan working with artists, at the theme park, design directors and colorists, and different point of view. And I realized how dogmatic we were, even though I had this really broad experience. We don't realize how dogmatic we are as architects until we work with artists.
Yeah.
We have rules for themselves. Yeah. So that was great. And then and honestly, just the time I spent looking at the landscapes and the gardens and the temples and the tea houses, and just, it really changed some of my point of view.
So what brought you back to the US after 4 months?
Well, I had a 3 month contract. So I traveled around for a month.
Okay.
I came back and went to work for Keating, Van Jernigan, Rote, Richard Keating, Lauren Rote. It was like a spin-off of SOM at that time. Was there for 2 years as a senior designer. And
so back in California?
Back in LA, yeah. And then I went to Thane Roberts, who was, we were doing Armani stores in San Francisco and in Beverly Hills, and did that for a while. And basically at that point it was recession. So it was just following like wherever the work was.
Right. Yeah. I remember that recession.
Yeah. I was lucky that I was the most I went without working was a month. So I just kept following the work. Yeah. And then they'd run out of work and I'd go on to the next one. And by the end of that, by 94, I was working at the Nadel Partnership, which was a big corporate firm. And doing a lot of work in China. It was early into China, almost 30 years ago. And that was fascinating. And actually a lot of it was master planning and city planning. Oh, just giant scale, like 50,000 units of housing. And, the beginning of what's happened in China. And that really got me interested in urban design, actually. And then I got licensed and basically looked around and thought, where do I want to be in 5 years? And that was what made me realize, what did I do all this for? And to go out on my own and to do my own work. There was nobody left I wanted to work for to learn.
Yeah, with that resume, it's like you checked all the boxes. It's like, where do I go now? I've done it all.
It was just like, it was time. There's the only thing holding me back at that point was paycheck. And, I had some money saved up and realized I could start on my own and support myself if I had to, for, up to a year. And that's what got me going.
And what was that's the beginning of Macintosh Porous?
So that was the beginning of me on my own in LA.
Okay,
and
in LA. Okay.
Yes, Doug Macintosh we grew up together in the same neighborhood. He was in a two-story tech built home.
So another born architect into.
Exactly. We grew up, we used to take art classes together. We were friends. We went to Michigan together. Then we went to New Haven together, worked at Cedar Pelley. So he stayed and finished his master's at Yale. I went to California. He got a project in Detroit back around this time, 94. And, we both left 15 years before, and most of our friends had left. And so I had some time. So I came to Detroit for like 3 weeks to work with them. You know, we had a couple of houses and they were great projects. And it just led to more. So next thing I knew, I was commuting between LA and Detroit. And by the following summer of 95, I just packed up LA and moved to Detroit.
And started that firm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that was in 95?
I originally came back in October of 94. And then by the summer of 95, we had actually moved into the office we're in. We were working out of a basement of a home then that we were renting. And I really, it was partly, again, at that point, I wasn't that interested in coming back to Detroit. I was open to it. Okay, I'll go see. And it was what got me. I mean, there was a few things. So our first clients were wealthy, sophisticated people. The first house we worked on was a great Gunnar Burkert's house from the 60s, the Lewis house. It had been on the cover of Architectural Record. It was definitely known at the time. And it was a renovation of that house for a couple who owned the largest antique Lalique glass collection in the world.
Wow.
And renovating the house for the collection. And that was actually great. And then, that led to other houses like that. So we were getting these $1 million, multi-million dollar homes.
How did you make those connections to get those early jobs at that level?
So Doug's mother owned a modeling agency here. She had started when we were kids, and she supplied models for the auto shows. So she was a hustler. She was just a real hustler. And so that first house she got for Doug at the beauty salon, sitting next to the client, Mrs. Shapiro, who was complaining. She'd interviewed all these local architects,
yep.
Didn't like them. So Doug's mother was like, oh, well, my son's an architect, blah, blah, blah. And, went in the back room and said, get your ass on a plane and went home and changed her answering machine to be his office number, which to this day, our office number is her old phone number.
That's awesome.
And that got us going. And then honestly, once you're in that circle, we just started getting passed
right,
around.
Right. Once you get one. So you leveraged your network to get that first job.
Yes. Yes. It literally. Yes. And then it just turned into, people they knew. And next thing we knew, it was, that was how that started. Because the two of us coming back with the pedigree and the education,
right. And,
there wasn't the architects that were here were older. There was sort of a missing generation,
mm-hmm.
Because Detroit being Detroit, it was, there just weren't many people.
Yeah, everybody left.
Right, exactly. So we were 32 and we're like, wow, this is, a million, it was garage additions in LA versus amazing houses on beautiful lakes in Detroit.
Yeah.
So that was it. But the biggest thing, the biggest attraction was when going downtown. And downtown at that point in Detroit was, it was like Berlin after the war.
That's what I wanted to ask you. What was the state of Detroit in 95?
It was Berlin after the war. There were 90 vacant buildings downtown, so it was nearly completely vacant. Barely anyone there. I mean, the Renaissance Center had emptied out the sort of core of downtown, and the core was these 90 vacant buildings were these amazing early 20th century skyscrapers that were built, you know, from 1900 to into the 1930, when Detroit boomed, when the auto industry exploded. And you know, so it was New York, Chicago, and Detroit at that time. And so Detroit at that time was like the Silicon Valley of today.
Right. It was the tech center of the world.
It was. And so the amount of money and the amount of development happening at the time was literally, it was, you know, in New York, Chicago, LA, or New York, Chicago, Detroit. So there was a real great history. And we used to actually say, you know, it was the first to grow and then the first to go. So it grew in this early 20th century, and then it actually started to decline in 1953. And when I say decline, I'm talking about the city of Detroit itself. It, you know, that's when the freeways started getting built and people started moving out to the suburbs to this day. So there's like 5 million people in metropolitan Detroit and 600,000 in Detroit proper. And, you know, so that's, but it was just, we decided, you know, 32 years old, that's where we should be as young architects. We thought we could actually make a difference here. You know, New York and LA and Chicago and San Francisco, they were done. They were out of the oven, you know, and I mean, there, of course, there's stuff to do there, but as young architects, doing these, you know, million-dollar homes and, you know, starting from, I don't want to say nothing, because there was stuff there, but very little development happened in the city.
Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. This episode is brought to you by FreshBooks. There's a lot to love about being an entrepreneur architect, right? But trying to figure out our financials on our own is not one of those things. Luckily, we have FreshBooks, the all-in-one accounting solution that's built for business owners like us. FreshBooks takes all the not-so-fun parts of running a business, from building and tracking invoices, to managing online payments, to organizing expenses, and automates them with features like the digital bills and receipt scanner, saving you up to 11 hours a week in the process. It's also super easy to get up and running, and the award-winning FreshBooks support team, they are always available to answer any questions along the way. Compare that to some of the other financial management tools out there. Try FreshBooks for free for 30 days, no credit card required. Go to freshbooks.com/architect to get started today. That's freshbooks.com/architect. So what will you do with 11 more hours each week? This episode is brought to you by RCAT.com. We all have that one story, that one project that had such a unique situation that it required a solution that you had rarely considered before. We share these stories in private professional circles with our friends and our colleagues, but there has never been a collection of these stories of conflict and triumph all in one place until now. Detailed is a podcast series that features architects, engineers, builders, and manufacturers who share their insights and expertise as they highlight some of the most complex, interesting, and oddball building conditions that they have ever encountered, and the ingenuity it took to solve them. Join host Charisse Lakeside, aka CSI Kraken, a senior specifications writer at RDH Building Science, as she uncovers lessons learned to help you navigate similar challenges that may arise in your next project. Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. Listen and subscribe right now at rcat.com/podcast. That's rcat.com/podcast, A-R-C-A-T www.dreamhouse.com/podcast. Detailed. Every building has a story. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So you were involved in the rebirth, the renaissance of Detroit right from the beginning, right? Because you were there before it started.
Yes.
What started it? How did it begin to come back?
Well, so it never really went away. It had declined for sure.
Right.
There were always people trying to get it going, but it was a struggle. The first thing that we got involved with was a committee for the mayor's office there was a proposal at that time to tear down not just the Hudson's building, which eventually was torn down, but all the buildings on Woodward Avenue next to the Hudson's building from Grand Circus Park to Campus Martius, and to make a bigger park. And we thought that was a horrible idea because it was already surrounded by Campus Martius, and then down the street, the riverfront. It's like you didn't need it. You'd be looking at the backs of buildings. And the mayor was basically said, well, that's what he was being told, you know. And luckily, a woman we knew, Marilyn Wheaton, you know, said, well, he wanted to challenge that. And he actually said to her, well, if you can come up with a better idea, do it. So she went. And, you know, we met her through someone else, and we got on this committee and worked for like 6 months coming up with an alternative of what to do with these, you know, rather than tear these down. And that was basically to turn downtown into and these old buildings to renovate them and turn them into residential mixed use, you know, cultural entertainment.
Right.
District. And, you know, the mayor actually would say, well, why don't we have a Soho? And, you know, so it was like, so we looked at cities, a lot of other cities around the country, Denver and Charlotte and Charleston and Milwaukee, places that some of these things were happening. And then coming from LA, you know, Pasadena, Old Town Pasadena and Santa Monica, like I'd already seen that happen. New Haven had had some of this happen. Doug had actually worked on there in the Ninth Ward. So we had some background. So we, you know, we developed this plan. It's called the New Avenues Plan. And the mayor took it. And out of that, in 96, the Downtown Detroit Partnership was formed. And that was a public-private entity to actually make this happen. And that was sort of the beginning of it.
Wow. So that project was the seed of this new renaissance that we all hear about in the news. That was the beginning of it, the tipping point.
It was a very little tipping point, yes. The tipping point of architects actually saying, hey, wait, don't tear these down.
Right.
We can renovate them. We can turn them into something. They're worth something. You know, and everyone looks at these other cities, you know, but meanwhile, all anyone did here was tear things down.
Right.
So, yes, that was the beginning. And then, so this is 96, and then we spent the next the rest of the 90s trying to convince people to renovate buildings and, you know, or mothball them and not tear them down.
Yeah. What was your argument for saving historic architecture rather than just tearing it down and putting up something new and modern?
Well, there was a few. One was they were Detroit. If you lost those, you'd have nothing. So you would be building Dallas or, you know, Atlanta or,
right.
you know, basically it wouldn't be authentic. So you know, and they were rich, and you couldn't replicate these today. You know, and that was a big one. The more important one that actually got headway was the financial argument. So we knew Doug was very involved in preservation and was the head of Preservation Wayne, and you know, we knew about things like historic tax credits, and nobody was utilizing them here. So there was federal historic tax credits, and then we actually helped work on getting the state to create state historic tax credits, and we actually we helped create some historic districts so that when developers went to try to tear something down, they would have to go to the historic district commission. Right, so it was like a way to sort of like sneakily, you know,
right, put some barriers in the way so it wasn't so easy to just tear things down.
Exactly. Yes. And so we spent a lot of time doing that, which from my background, you know, all this modern stuff, the kernel for me was, you know, if you look back at like Mies, that glass tower he designed for Berlin, you know, that beautiful rendering of the glass tower within, and maybe it was Vienna, I don't remember. But, you know, so to do modern, you sort of need the context. And it's like, you don't want, we didn't want to lose the context of the city.
Yeah, right.
So eventually we knew someday, which is now, you know, maybe we'd be building new buildings. And so it's like, I mean, not only renovating them and turning them into, you know, residential, commercial, mixed use, but, you know, eventually building things in contrast to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that, as you described your background with all of that modern architecture and all the experience in those modern firms, and then knowing where you are today in Detroit and doing or have your history in Detroit, saving and renovating and restoring the historic buildings, it's very interesting to hear that that becomes the foundation, sort of the context of which you, then you can go back to your modern roots and design something with some context that, that you can reflect and respond to.
Yes.
Very interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the context, so context to me was like Richard Serra, the way Richard Serra looks at context and the way his work, you know, is, you know, makes you look at that context in a different way. So I wasn't necessarily looking at it contextually like in postmodernism.
Oh, sure. It, right. Right. Yep.
You know, and so I just thought, you know, that was what was going to be most interesting. And certainly over time, that the adaptive reuse we do, like that's a lot of fun of it. And even the urban planning, urban design is like, well, how do we incorporate what's here, you know, into something new and really make it an authentic place? And, you know, but again, the financial part was a big piece of it. It became an argument for keeping once we actually helped educate people about tax credits and, you know, all these things that would actually help fill a gap of paying for things. It was helped a lot.
Do you imagine or do you propose that Detroit and the lessons learned at Detroit can be used in other cities that need that sort of help in terms of bringing a city back from, you know, from this vacant sort of forgotten state? There are cities all throughout North Carolina where I am that you can see that at one time they were thriving and now they're not, and they need something to bring them back. And so do you imagine that using Detroit sort of as a case study is a good way to look at that for those cities?
Absolutely, for sure. And even back then we thought, you know, like I said, you know, it's first to grow, first to go. So, you know, well, it's going to become, it's potentially a model for,
right,
you know, about ways of, you know, other cities to sort of come back. And I, you know, there were definitely examples that we were seeing, you know, in Denver and other places where, you know, historic buildings were being brought back, but many of those cities didn't fall as far as Detroit.
Right, for sure. Had. Yeah.
So that it's more complex, but absolutely there's a lot to learn here that can be applied to other cities.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. There are a lot of, I mean, the major cities, obviously there are a few cities that are at Detroit's stature and size that have gone so far as Detroit had gone. But there are hundreds of smaller cities that were built around some industry that is no longer there that are just vacant, right? They're just abandoned. And so learning some of the lessons that Detroit went through, maybe some of these smaller cities could learn from those and be able to, you know, become reborn themselves.
Absolutely. And there's so many different ways. I mean, there's a few things happening now, like, you know, architectural buildings, the renovations and existing building work just surpassed new building recently. So, so the amount of fee being generated, there's more fee being generated from adaptive reuse. So the whole sustainability conversation can have a big impact, because the most sustainable thing we can do,
right,
to renovate existing buildings and keep existing buildings. And so it's a very pertinent argument now. So there's that. There's the potential financial benefits of historic tax credits and brownfield tax credits and all these things that help actually, you know, get the developments, you know, funded and going. And then there's the character of those buildings,
right,
in these towns that, you know, that create these sort of mixed use places that people want to live. And there's another piece, like the most affordable city in the country for entry level housing is Detroit. And so, you know, my employees, you know, buy houses in Detroit for, you know, $50,000, $100,000 and renovate them and, you know, and live in these really nice houses, and, you know, that they renovate. And, you know, you can't do that in New York or Chicago or LA, right, San Francisco or Seattle. So I think, you know, some of these neighborhoods you go to now, and like one, there's a great coffee shop in an old church. And I was in it a few weeks ago, and I'm looking around, and I could have been in Brooklyn. But it was, you know, except I know the people in there live in that neighborhood in these houses that they're buying for very little and renovating. And the city's actually putting in parks and bike paths. And, you know, so it's now spreading out. And this has taken a while into the neighborhoods. There's a lot of lessons to be learned from here.
Yeah. Very, very interesting. Michael, thank you for coming by and sharing your story. It's a super interesting story to hear your background and then what's happening in Detroit and your role in the Renaissance of Detroit is really interesting. So thank you for that. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you the one question that I ask everybody. What's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
So early on, you know, so I had that design background, you know, at all these firms, right? But once I went out on my own, I realized how little I knew about, you know, business and running a firm and, you know, payroll taxes and just, you know, which we missed the first year. I mean, you know, really bad.
Right.
Thought we were doing well. And then the end of the year, it's like, what do you mean we owe $70,000 in payroll taxes?
Surprise.
You know, architecture school is not something we necessarily focus on. So I learned from some other architects that, the AIA, which I had, of course, never been part of or thought about, you know, because when you're in school and you're in design field, you know, we all think, oh, bad. But at that moment, I went to the National conference, like back, this was like the late 90s. And all of a sudden I realized, wow, there's all these seminars and all these workshops and all these things that address the things I don't know.
Right.
And it actually is a resource, a professional resource that was valuable to me. And so I've gone almost every year. And I recently, this last one that was in Chicago, I took, I don't know, four or five people from my office. So that they could walk the floor and see the products and go to these seminars. And I think it's very valuable as a professional, tool.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I've been to the AI conference as far back as I can remember. I don't remember where I started, but I go every year and we'll be there again in San Francisco. Entree Architect, every time we go, we sort of grow on what we do there and bringing our community together while we're at the conference. And so hopefully we'll see you in San Francisco. We'll be there.
Yes.
And we look forward to it. That's a great suggestion and answer to that question.
Good.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The last conference that was in San Francisco, I basically did the tour the whole time. And there was an article in the paper. They interviewed me and pointed that out. Like, because I went to the convention, but all I did was the tours.
Yeah. Because
the tours are always amazing. And which is another piece of why it's a great thing to go to, because you see different cities and what they're doing. And I learned a lot, brought that back to Detroit too.
Yeah. There's so much to do at the convention. The thing I like to do is just connect. I like to connect with the people that I interact with every day online and have an opportunity to, meet them one-on-one and say hi and network and sort of dream about what we can do and sort of help one another grow.
Yeah. Well, on the floor, building in Detroit, it's expensive and the rents and we've had to figure out how to build for less.
Yeah.
So I would go and search the floor for products, especially exterior products that, we could use to help bring the price cost down. And that was great.
His name is Michael Porras. You can learn more about Michael and the work that he's doing in Detroit at MacintoshPorras.com. They're also active on Instagram and Facebook. We'll have links to all of that on the show notes. So just go to the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Michael, thank you for the work that you do. Your story is fascinating to hear your story and all the traveling and all the firms that you've worked in and the work that you're doing today in Detroit, helping Detroit come back from what it once had declined to become. And your role in that is interesting, but I appreciate you for that. I appreciate you for going back to Detroit and helping Detroit become what it is today. And so thank you for that. And thank you for coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entree Architect Podcast.
Great. Thank you.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, share a link with a friend. That's how Entree Architect has grown to serve thousands of architects just like you. Please share a rating, write a review, share a link to this episode with a friend. I'd appreciate it. Links to all our sponsors and all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. It's the network dedicated to architects, engineers, and construction pros. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at Gable Media at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. Go check it out. We have, I think, 13 podcasts over there now, gablemedia.com. And before we wrap up, a special thank you to our partners at Graphisoft for helping our community of architects make the transition to BIM with ArchiCAD software. Go now to graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect and see how Graphisoft is positioning to help make your architecture firm a success. Visit graphisoft.com/US/EntreeArchitect to learn more. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage. Love learn, and go share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.